verify that this is working all right?
Sure.
Which looks like it is. And with that, why don't we get started? Today is, to remind myself, it's January. Yes. This great weather. January 23rd, 1995. And this is Jim Boning speaking with Dr. James Roth at his home in Sarasota, Florida. Dr. Roth, I know you were born in Rahway, New Jersey on December 7th, 1925. Could you tell me something about your father and mother and your family background?
So my father and mother were both immigrants to the U.S. They came here from Hungary and Czechoslovakia. The reason I say both of them is that parts of Hungary became Czechoslovakia after World War II, and they came here shortly after World War II. And my mother was a person of limited education.
And I'm sorry, you mean World War II or World War I?
I'm sorry, World War I. World War I, you're correct. World War I. That would have been maybe about 1919 or 1920, perhaps. We both came here about that time. My father had had some education, and he was, in fact, in the early stages of going to medical school in Czechoslovakia when World War I broke out. He went into the military, served his time there, and when he came back, circumstances were such that he was not able to, reasons of religious persecution, he was not able to continue his education there, and he emigrated to the United States. And
had he known your mother in Europe?
No, they met here.
They met here.
They met here in the United States.
And did he settle in Rahway? Is that
well? During the earliest years in the United States, he moved around, and I can't recount. I know he lived in Western Pennsylvania for a short period of time. He lived in Rahway, and then when I was quite young, he moved to Yonkers, New York. I lived in Yonkers up to the age of about five, and then from that point we moved to the Bronx in New York. And I lived in the Bronx until I, through high school and through my first year of college, following which the family moved to Western Pennsylvania, remained there, and never again returned to live in New York.
I started my graduate work at NYU in the Bronx. So I'm wondering where in the Bronx you were living.
Well, you were in
the Heights campus.
Well, then I was not terribly far. I lived in a part of the Bronx that was called High Bridge, which there was a bridge that went from the Bronx to Manhattan called Washington Bridge at around 170th Street. I lived one half block south of that on a street called, small street called Ogden Avenue. But then I lived there while I attended most of my grade school, through most of my grade school, junior high school, and high school education.
What was it like growing up in the Bronx at that time?
Well, it was part of the time that I was there was we moved there just about the early stages of the Depression, and I have a very vague recollection of going with my mother to various places to get food stamps and food, because we were getting that kind of help at the time in the Bronx. Most of the people that I knew, I don't know if that's going to be
it might. This is pretty sensitive.
Maybe you may want to turn it off. Well, it was an interesting time because most of the schoolmates that I had were, like myself, children of European immigrants, and there was a very high parental guidance towards getting a good education, doing well in school, going to college, and availing oneself of the great opportunities that there were in the United States. And as things evolved for me, I ended up being associated with a very bright group of people, because at that time in New York City they had something called the Rapid Advance classes, and I had the good fortune to enter them. And in fact, my education was so accelerated that I graduated high school at the age of 15. I skipped a couple of classes in grade school, skipped a year in junior high school, such that I got at least 2 years ahead of my time. Then I had the good fortune to be in the first class of something called... Maybe you want to just...
Okay.
First class at the Bronx High School of Science. I don't know if you...
Oh, yes.
If you're from the Bronx, know about it. I was in that first class, and that was quite an experience, because as, in a sense, an experiment in that kind of specialized education, we had a really extraordinary faculty in the school, and sort of a hand-picked group of students. So that from that point on, which is really in my case, since I graduated at 15, that means I spent my last 3 years, from the ages of 12 to 15, I was surrounded by some very bright teachers and very bright classmates.
Had you developed an interest in science before this?
No, not really. In fact, if I were asked, well, why did I choose to go there, I cannot attribute it to any specific prior experience or any parental guidance. So, in fact, there was no one in my family who had any background in the field of science or who encouraged me in any way. It was just I heard about it. It was a new experiment in education. It sounded challenging and interesting, and so I applied and got accepted.
Was it a competitive exam type of thing?
I don't think it was a competitive exam per se, but I think it may have depended on my prior academic record. You had to have a certain... I'm sure they set certain minimum standards for your grade averages up to that point before they selected the students, because they did have quite a bit more applications than they were able to handle. So that was it. In fact, I was told, and I don't know whether that was true or not, but it was kind of comforting to hear it, but that there was some competition among the faculty to be able to teach at this school.
Okay. Well, what did you find, having no previous interest in science? What was your first experience like when you got there?
Sorry, I don't have... My only positive, I'm trying to recall here. My most positive experiences were those in chemistry, because I had a very engaging teacher in chemistry, a man by the name of Saul Geffner, and the fact that I remember his name, because I couldn't give you the name of any other person there, any of the other teachers, that is. some indication of the impression that he made. And he just presented chemistry in a way that was always challenging. And I remember one of the simple things that he kind of always stressed in his teaching was asking the question why. Was it was not just a question of learning equations and learning chemical facts, but trying to understand the nature of chemical phenomenon. And I would say that probably if there was any single thing that I particularly got out of my association with him, it was being imbued with that spirit of understanding. And the other thing, of course, was having science presented in a stimulating and engaging way.
Did you have a laboratory experience with that?
I don't remember.
Okay. Well, the school was brand new, maybe.
Well, the school, actually, it was an old, abandoned building of one of the other... There were, in the Bronx, there was DeWitt Clinton.
Oh, yes, yes.
And Vander Childs, I think that was... Clinton, I think, was a boys' school, and the other was a girls' school. And we inherited an old building of one of those that was abandoned. It was in the... was in fact probably not terribly far from the NYU campus, because I think I would get on a streetcar that kind of swung by the NYU campus and then may have headed on east. I do not know the address, although I probably have it upstairs somewhere. Mm-hmm. I have a yearbook from the Bronx High School of Science.
Being a high school of science, did that mean you concentrated on physics, math, chemistry, biology? Did you get anything else that would outside of the sciences?
Yeah, well, yes. As a matter of fact, I was extremely interested in English and got involved on the editorial staff of the school newspaper. And probably during those years, probably as an extracurricular activity, spent more time being involved in the school newspaper than in some of the other activities.
Were there any forgotten where we were? You were talking about English and...
Yes, I would say this, that by the time I graduated from the Bronx High School of Science, I don't think there was anything in my accomplishments or attitude that would have suggested that I was going to pursue and enjoy a fruitful career in chemistry. In fact, when I finished chemistry, to my disbelief today, I try to discuss with my father, who had absolutely no background or knowledge of the world of science in general, what I should do. Well, I was going to try to get into City College because I really couldn't afford to go anywhere else, but I had some choices. I could go to the Uptown campus, or he encouraged me to enter the business school of City College. So I did that. And I attended the business school of City College for 1 year.
This is when you were 15?
Yes.
Okay.
And I really was extremely unhappy there. And both unhappy, and in contrast to my prior academic record at the Bronx High School of Science, I barely got through. So I decided that at the end of that year, I would go back to the pursuit of a career in science and specifically in chemistry. And that was coincident with the time when my family moved to Western Pennsylvania.
Had you had any more interaction with Geffner in terms of...
None. None ever.
After your class?
None ever.
So that decision to pursue chemistry was strictly yours?
Yes.
Okay.
I went to, my family moved to Western Pennsylvania, and I entered the University of West Virginia. And when I did so, I entered as an aspiring graduate in chemistry.
Okay.
So I entered the chemistry curriculum.
Why West Virginia as opposed to Pitt or Duquesne or?
Well, at that particular time, the Pitt was a private institution. There was always a financial problem, and the closest land grant college, which is the one of lowest cost, was the one at the University of West Virginia, which was 26 miles from my home.
Okay.
And at that time, because I was out of state, the cost was $40 a semester. Had I been in state, it would have been $20 a semester. So it was dictated, my choice there was dictated largely by financial issues.
And what did you do your first year at West Virginia in terms of being a chemistry major? Did it cement your choice?
Yes, it did. I seemed to be reasonably happy there and did fairly well academically at the University of West Virginia, where the caliber of students were and student competition was not anywhere near as strong as it had been at City College or at the Bronx High School of Science.
So you were...
Because it was kind of on the other side of the spectrum. So academically, I became sort of a superstar at to whatever extent, you know, I did very well academically at West Virginia.
So you were 16 when you entered?
Yes.
Okay. Did you feel that put you at a disadvantage, being several years younger than the traditional freshman?
Socially, yes.
But academically?
Academically, I think I held my own reasonably well.
What was the chemistry department like there at that time? That would have been 40, 41? Just before
I graduated in 41, so that would have been 42.
42.
Yeah, that was 42.
So the war had started when you went there.
Yes. I was 16 when the war started, and it would have been in 41.
So you were still too young for the draft at that point.
Yes, but at the end of one year at West Virginia, I decided to enlist in the Navy at age 17, which I did do after 1 year. And I entered something called the Navy V-12 program, which was a program for an officer training program. And I was accepted for that and spent two academic semesters then at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, and at the end of that time, that was all that they were going to support me for. I was then sent to midshipman school at Columbia University at the age of 18. Mm. And
right in the middle of the war. This was
in the middle of the war. Got my commission as an ensign, and then was assigned to the amphibious forces. Mm. And was in the Navy a total of 3 years.
Where did you serve after that in the Navy?
Well, after I got my commission, I was assigned to the amphibious forces, and I served in the Pacific.
Okay.
And was involved in the Battle of Iwo Jima. Mm-hmm. And a number of others that came along. I became a navigator aboard the ship. I was a navigator at the age of 19 during the engagement at Iwo Jima.
That is probably a more maturing experience than you could have asked for. At that age, that makes you grow up in a hurry, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, we had some exciting times there. We're just, I guess, the day after the invasion at Iwo Jima, we were carrying the 25 medium Sherman tanks of the 3rd Marine Tank Battalion, and they were having a terrible time aboard the island. The battle was not going well, so we were getting ready to provide our tanks to the battle, but we got hit by a kamikaze plane and a 500-pound bomb. And unfortunately, I was running the ship at the time, because we had had an accident aboard the ship. Someone had accidentally killed themselves, one of the officers, that afternoon, and they were having, all the older officers were having a burial at sea ceremony when the attack came, and we didn't think anybody thought we could survive that, but we did. And then we hung around, and about 2 days later they had a desperate need for our tanks. We had taken on so much water that we couldn't beach. They had to get an armada of tugs to push us up the beach and get those Marines and their tanks off of the ship, which they did do. And I think the Marine group made a contribution to the successful ending of that battle. But anyhow, that's...
You said, if I could back up for a moment, you had 1 year at West Virginia, then 1 year at Penn. But did you take chemistry classes at Penn?
Yes. In fact, it was kind of curious, because most of the people that were in the V-12 unit at Penn were people who were there because of the Wharton Business School. Okay. That was the driving force for their attendance at Penn. But somehow or other, I had requested and gotten assignment to Penn, and I was about the only one in the V-12 group that pursued the curriculum in chemistry. And so I took several courses there. Then after the war was over with, I then returned home and finished my fourth and final year at the University of West Virginia.
You said you had one at...
I had one at City College.
Oh, that's right. Okay. Yeah, so you really...
One at...
West Virginia,
two semesters at Penn, which is really the equivalent of a year, and then a final year at... As a matter of fact, I was kind of puzzled, because when I finished at the University of West Virginia, I did so rather suddenly, because I was expecting to have to go another semester in order to fulfill the requirements for a BS degree, because of the time I lost at business college at City College. But I then learned that if I was satisfied with a BA degree in chemistry, that I could actually finish at the end of that fourth year, and I elected to do that. And when I did that, I was totally unprepared as to what to do with my life, because there I was going to graduate. I had no idea I knew absolutely nothing about the nature and existence of graduate school. And so I had a meeting with my professor in physical chemistry, who I admired greatly, and we just
his
had
his name. I don't mean to put you on the spot, if you remember.
No, I can see his face, but I can't come up with his name.
Okay.
He was a professor of physical chemistry at the University of West Virginia. Anyhow, he explained to me what graduate school was like, what you did at graduate school, and so forth. And he also mentioned to me a few possibilities. At that time, the employment situation was quite bad. So I was entitled under the GI Bill to at least 4 years of college. So I made an application to three or four universities with no guidance from anybody, including him. And the first one that accepted me was the University of Maryland. and they offered me an assistantship and a package that would permit me to go there at essentially no cost. All my expenses between the assistantship and the GI Bill would be taken care of. And I went there for expecting to go there for a year or so to get a master's degree. But once I got there and learned something of the nature of research and started doing research, I knew within a week after I was involved in research that I was not going to stop with a master's degree. I was going to go on for a PhD degree. So my pathway to getting a PhD degree was not a very well-guided or structured endeavor from the point of view of input I got from anybody else. I just kind of stumbled my way to that pathway.
Why physical chemistry? What was it about physical chemistry that attracted you?
I guess you'd think I'd be able to answer that question, but I really can't. I guess what happened was that at an early stage in graduate school, I had to go and interview several faculty members, and they represented a cross-section of analytical chemistry, organic chemistry, and physical chemistry. And for some reason or other, the area of kinetics and reaction mechanisms sounded more appealing. Maybe the linkage might have been, and I've never thought about the question until you presented it here, might have been this instilling in me this question of finding out why reactions occurred or happened as they did. The Geffner influence, and somehow or other kinetics and reaction mechanisms may have had a linkage to that. I don't know, I'm just speculating here.
Because my next question was, then, how was your math background? Had you picked up enough mathematics along the way as an undergraduate?
Yes, I would say that I had taken calculus, through calculus, as part of the requirements for getting the undergraduate degree in the BA degree in physical chemistry required, because I had courses in thermodynamics and in electrochemistry, which required a background in calculus. I did adequately in mathematics, but I would not characterize it as one of my stronger subjects.
And you then worked with, I don't know how to pronounce his name,
Sverbely. Bill Sverbely was my advisor. And that was kind of an interesting experience, because without even realizing what was happening there, he had selected a very narrow area of kinetics as the area of his interest in research. And what he was trying to determine was the influence of dielectric constant of reaction media, liquid reaction media, on various types of reactions. For example, if they were reactions between ions like or unlike ions, or between an ion and a neutral molecule. The theory predicted certain effects which could be quantified on the rates of those reactions. And that was the area that all of the students had worked in. Then, when I got into it, I studied a reaction, the cyanohydrin reaction, in which it became clear that the rates of the reaction were strongly influenced by the acidity and basicity. And I had some early indications that this might be an example of generalized acid-base catalysis. And this was an area that he had never gotten into himself. But since I was beginning to make some progress in the area, I ended up pursuing it and getting my thesis in that area, and in fact never investigated the influence of dielectric constant, but rather pursued the area of generalized acid-base catalysis for reactions in aqueous solution. And subsequently, after I left, he then pursued that area himself. So.
Yes, because your paper, based on the thesis published in 1953, was number one in the series. The one that you wrote with him in Jax was paper number one. So I didn't look at the others because your name wasn't on them. So
yeah, no, it wasn't.
It was the beginning.
But he had. I never did follow up, but I know that there was a. He had at least one more student who pursued other aspects of that, and. It was kind of an interesting experience because it got me into the world of mechanistic studies of chemical reactions, but in addition to that, it aroused an interest on my part in what I'm going to call asymmetric catalysis. Because one of the examples of the references was a case in which someone had used a naturally occurring, quinine, optically active quinine and quinidine, and had produced optically active cyanohydrins. I was absolutely fascinated by that because it had some mechanistic implications. But it took many, many years after that before I got around to trying to pursue that.
Well, you did get into some asymmetric work, asymmetric synthesis work, much later on.
Not directly. Not really directly.
No, this was, I'm thinking of L-DOPA.
Yes. But the L-DOPA work was done by a man by the name of Bill Knowles, and Bill got into that work because of work that I and my colleagues had started in homogeneous catalysis with rhodium complexes.
Okay.
And if time permits, we may get into how that happened, because I think that has now evolved into one of the major research themes in organic chemistry today throughout the world.
Well, within a week at being in Maryland, you knew this is what you wanted. You knew your eyes were open to research. And what had you thought about as you finished up your PhD, which was 51, what had you thought about in terms of beyond life after the PhD? Academic work considered, or were you looking at an industrial career from the beginning?
Well, I was looking at an industrial, government or industrial position. I never considered an academic career very much because I never received any encouragement or guidance in that direction.
You ended up at the Franklin Institute. How did you arrive there from Maryland?
Well, at that time, when I graduated in 1951, jobs were very scarce, and there were a fair number of my fellow graduates at Maryland who did not even get a job initially. And so I think I ended up with possibly two job opportunities. There was that one at the Franklin Institute, and there may have been one at a government laboratory. But it was one of the few specific opportunities that I had.
What was the Franklin Institute like in 1951? You did work in photochemistry, combustion chemistry, and there was one paper that was published at least, or at least you gave it at a symposium on solid propellants. But I guess the general question is, what was it like at the Franklin Institute, and then what were you assigned to work on?
Well, the Franklin Institute was a place that performed almost entirely contract research. So, I guess when I got there, I joined a very small chemistry department. The Franklin Institute Laboratories itself was quite small, and it always seemed to be surviving barely. Mm. And I guess about the time I arrived, they received an invitation to propose some research. This was, I think, in the Korean War, and they were experiencing a very serious practical problem, and that is that mortars, which were being used in the very exceptionally cold climate of parts of Korea, when they were fired, they would blow up and detonate, injuring or killing the people who were operating the mortars. And there had been almost no prior record of that happening. And so they wanted to learn more about this. And in fact, it was at that time that my path crossed that of Stuart Churchill.
Oh.
Because at the time, he was at the University of Michigan, must have been a younger person like myself, and he had a contract pursuing a certain path. And I learned about this, and I decided to submit a proposal. And I was given somebody who was more mechanically inclined than I was, and we designed a high pressure experimental apparatus in which we were going to attempt to simulate the ignition stages of solid propellants. And we studied the kinetics and mechanism of that, and thought that we had eventually developed an understanding of what was going on. And so that was my first research experience at the Franklin Institute as a researcher doing a study in kinetics and mechanism, except of the ignition of solid propellants. And we had a contract that went on for maybe 3 years in this. And what in fact happened is that there's a whole sequence of very complex solid state liquid surface and gas phase reactions that go on when the propellant gets ignited. And what can happen when the propellant is very cold is that it goes through the sequence, you get a buildup of what was called fizz gases, highly combustible gases, which do not themselves get ignited into the desired progression of reactions, and you get this accumulation. And then, when the fizz reaction goes, instead of progressing in a normal combustion sequence, you get a detonation of these fizz gases, and that's what was causing it. Now, we never did work on what to do about it, but at least we had some understanding of what we had achieved. So, but about that time, we had a chance to bid on another job, so to speak, and there was a consortium. The American Petroleum Institute had become very concerned about the smog problem in California. And at that particular time, there was severe smog problems, and there was consideration was being given to shutting down part, if not major parts, of the refinery industry out in the Los Angeles Basin area, because it was thought that this man Hagenschmidt, who got a lot of well-deserved recognition, had established that it was the photochemical oxidation of hydrocarbons which would produce ozone, which caused crop damage, eye irritation, and deterioration of rubber tires and so forth. He was responsible for that. But we were asked to try to augment his work to gain a better understanding of the atmospheric photochemistry involved in smog formation. So at that time, I collaborated with a couple of people around, including some physicists there, and eventually came up with the idea that in order to study these reactions, a good way of doing this might be by something that we eventually called long path infrared spectroscopy. And what we would do is to create a long path chamber which had mirrors in it, and then put in synthetic mixtures of hydrocarbons, simulated air with nitrogen oxides, which were the photoinitiator, and then use banks of artificial sunlight, which had the spectral distribution similar to that. And so sat down, put all of this proposal together, and voila, we got accepted. And I was starting to work on this when all of a sudden I got a job offer from someone else at the GAF Laboratories in Easton, Pennsylvania, to join their central research laboratory and conduct research in catalysis.
Weren't you someplace else between Franklin Institute?
Oh yes. Oh, I forgot. No, that's not why. I did not go to GAF. I know what happened. That's right. Sorry about that. But what happened was that I decided to take a flyer and go into business on my own, subsidized by some family members, and decided to start up a paint and adhesives business in Allentown, Pennsylvania. So I left the Franklin Institute right after we had gotten the acceptance of this proposal, and I went, and I was in that for about 2 to 3 years before I finally realized I was not going to make my fortune in that venture, and that it was really a rather foolish thing, diversion for me to do. At that point, then, I decided to terminate that venture and look for another job. And the closest job that I could find in the living in Allentown, Pennsylvania, was this position in the Central Research Labs at GAF.
Okay.
And then I got started there.
So the paint company was really your idea. Why paint? How did you?
Well, when I was living in Philadelphia at the Franklin Institute, I had met someone, a neighbor, who claimed to have knowledge of some fantastic knowledge of some very good paints and adhesives that could provide us with a pathway for starting up an attractive business. And being young and innocent, I believed him. It turned out to be rather somewhat of a hoax, or grossly overstated, and after about a year of learning on my part about various aspects of the paint industry, why I began to realize what I had gotten into and what we had gotten into, and so we gave it a deadline for we terminated our relationship with this other man. So it was just a kind of a flyer. Mm-hmm. It was a business flyer. But in the course of doing that, I did get some interesting, I'm going to call it business experience, because I did since it was a very small operation, I did everything. I had to learn how to advertise products, how to create promotional literature, and how to deal and interact with commercial and business people. And anyhow, that was the nature of that 2 to 3 year diversion.
Okay, and from there then you went to GAF.
GAF.
Right.
And I was at GAF, I think, for a little over 2 years.
You've described your experiences there in somewhat graphic detail, given that...
Where did you catch up with that?
Somewhere...
maybe that article I wrote on the paper I gave on... receiving the first ACS
yes.
award in industrial
yes.
chemistry, some adventures in industrial chemistry.
Yes.
That's the first time I ever had an opportunity to describe that extremely interesting experience at GAF.
Yes, I mean, the catalyst was an acetylide, which, as you pointed out, acetylides are highly explosive materials, and yet... they had reached the point of using this as a catalyst until the plant had several disasters and then sent it back.
Yeah, well, actually, what happened was this technology had been developed during World War II by Reppe in Germany.
Okay.
So the development of the copper acetylide catalyst... Well, what had happened there was you may be familiar with this. If you're not, then it'll be slightly interesting. But what they were looking in Germany for was a totally synthetic route to rubber, because they could not get rubber from natural sources. So this brilliant chemist Reppe came up with the following scheme. They had lots of calcium carbide. They made acetylene. From acetylene, they reacted it with formaldehyde to make butanediol, which they then hydrogenated to 1,4-butanediol, and they dehydrogenated that to butadiene. That's how they got... Once they had butadiene, they made synthetic rubber from... And they actually practiced that as complex and as... That's how they got their rubber for in World War II. Well, when the war was over, GAF, which had been seized as an alien property by the U.S. government, was used as a vehicle for transferring some of the captured German technology. And there was a whole literature called the PB reports, which were reports of captured documents from the Germans. And there's a fascinating cloak and dagger story pertaining to how they got the documents for the butanediol technology. But they got them, and they got the books at GAF, and then GAF attempted to use this information acquired from Germany to develop and practice in the United States that technology, and it uses a copper acetylide catalyst. Well, they had been researching that for maybe well over 5 years, and they were at the point of starting up their commercial plant. It was just I may have arrived a week before the plant was, and when it was started up, it blew up. And then they tried to clear things out. Tried it a second time, it blew up again when they would turn valves. And what was happening was that the copper acetylide, which was dispersed on a siliceous support, would get leached and redeposited as pure unsupported copper acetylide and get deposited in valves. In the pure unsupported state, it was really a percussion material. It just... You could just touch it slightly and it would detonate. But in the supported state, it was okay. You could take precautions, which the Germans had developed for making it usable, because they had, in fact, after experiencing a number of accidents and detonations themselves, eventually learned how to use it. And the fact that that technology, that same technology, has been used gosh, you know what, now for 40 plus years, even in the United States, means it is, yes, it's hazardous, but if you know what you're doing, you can control it and operate it safely. So when I arrived, after the second explosion, the manufacturing department decided to return the process to R&D and say, when you've solved the problem, we'll consider reactivating this. Well, as you might imagine, that was the biggest investment that the GAF Corporation had made at that particular time. So this was a critical problem, and I had the good fortune to inherit that problem. Not for the engineers at the plant at Calvert City were trying to do all, but in terms of at the research stage, that was given to me as my initial assignment.
And you had, you described at least one explosion you had.
Well, what would happen was this, that what I was trying to do was learn something about the nature of these deposits. And we were able to find some conditions under which we could leach the copper acetylide out of the catalyst and then have it a solution containing the dissolved copper contact acetylene and form copper acetylide in a unsupported state. And that eventually became the thesis of what went on, but what we found was there were some conditions in which you could form a copper acetylide which was very sensitive and a form that was less sensitive. So what I wanted to do was use the advanced techniques of solid characterization and catalyst characterization, more advanced than any they had ever used there. And so I had to collect samples of these copper acetylide deposits of variable form, and one of them, I guess we didn't realize, was of this sensitive type, and my technician was carried it down to the analytical department underwater. And this stuff, if you touched it with a glass rod underwater, it would detonate. But you always dealt with very small quantities. But then they took the material and they had very carefully put it on a watch glass, and they were transferring it to weigh it so that they could, and when they transferred just to weigh it, it detonated with a sound that was heard throughout this four-story building. But
anyone injured?
Pardon me?
Anyone
no.
Injured?
Fortunately, the people that were involved were wearing face masks, mm-hmm. and nobody was injured. Nobody was injured with that. And I had a couple of sleepless nights because I would sometimes, while I was doing the research, I'd be at home and thinking about, gee, so-and-so is going to be taking samples out of that. Do they realize that those might be the dangerous materials? And I'd call people up in the middle of the night to just double-check and make sure that they were going to take the adequate precautions. But the bottom line was that what had happened was that their pilot plant was a 1-inch tubular reactor, and when they decided to build the commercial plant, they did not want to deviate at all from the pilot plant, so they built a reactor having hundreds if not thousands of these 1-inch reactors. And what would happen is that since that sometimes you would get a situation of acetylene starvation in one of those tubes. If you ever got a situation of acetylene starvation, that would then cause leaching of the copper. That leached copper would come at the bottom of the tube, hit unreacted acetylene, and voila, you've got this stuff. So once there's a case, but sometimes doing mechanistic studies doesn't always tell you what to do. Well, oops. Detail.
Absolutely. It's just perfect. It's really good.
Where
Let's see, the family that rambles from Italian Renaissance art to reminiscences in chemistry. But anyhow, what events, once we came up with this, then with the realization that this was what was happening, then the engineers down at Calvert City took steps to design and install what was needed to ensure that there was that no condition of acetylene starvation occurred in any of these tubes, and to set up a monitoring. And once that was done, the plant was restarted, and to the best of my knowledge, has, oh God, I can't believe it, 40 years continue to operate successfully. But that was an exciting experience, and it gave me an introduction, a real introduction to very applied catalytic science and technology from a materials and process point of view. Now, one of the very interesting things that I found happened in that GAF experience was that I found myself for the first time in my career, when I joined the company, I was assigned to a department that was populated almost entirely with chemical engineers. And I was virtually the only chemist in that department. But I got to learn more about the world of chemical engineering, the way engineers think about science and technology, than I had ever had before, or than I would ever know in the future. And ultimately, I think this had an important impact, because later on, when I went to Monsanto and I was able to set up a corporate catalysis department, I was determined at that point that it would not have the traditional organizational structure, which is you have a bunch of chemists doing the exploratory work in test tube or in flasks and small equipment, and then when you get a lead, then you pass it on to the engineers. They're in a different organization. They scale it up. They develop it. No, I had the department structured so that there were chemical engineers, research-minded chemical engineers, working with a chemist at the very earliest exploratory stage. And as we come to it later, it was that organizational feature which led to one of my people, a chemical engineer, being the inventor of the process used to produce Roundup.
Okay.
Some of the early days at Dow Chemical, the physics lab had a similar arrangement. They, within one group, they had a chemist, a chemical engineer, a mechanical engineer, a physicist, this big mix of people who all interacted together in the project. So that's very interesting. You said that there was one lesson you learned from that experience, and that was to elucidate any and all possible side reactions, their causes and consequences.
Okay, because from that experience, you sort of ask yourself the question, well, gee, what did we learn from this? Did anybody in all of the work that was done say, what are the possible side reactions? What happens if you have an excess of one or the other, or one of your reactants gets starved and so forth? No. But then, later on, when I got to be involved in the development of a very new process for Monsanto, the process for making acetic acid, where we're dealing with potentially hazardous material like carbon monoxide and so forth, we did just that. I had a very brilliant chemist by the name of Dennis Foster do some research on the chemistry of side reactions. What would happen if you had too much of this or too little of this? And he did. In fact, he won the Apatia Prize of the ACS as a result of his fundamental studies. Largely, well, he did some in the reaction, but he did such a thorough job of studying the conditions, we knew that you must never have a situation of CO starvation in the reactor, because if you did, you would precipitate rhodium metal or rhodium iodide all over the place, and you would have a disaster with the price of rhodium. With the price of rhodium in that process, you had to have 99.9% recovery of rhodium at all stages. So that's, I think it was that experience, and as I have moved on to see a research like at Air Products, that was not research that I was not in control of. Others have failed to do that. In some of the consulting I've done for other companies where they've called me in because they're having major problems at the multi-million dollar pilot plant stage, they have not done that. But part of, really, if you're going to do a first-class research job on a new chemical process, you have to really address all the what-ifs. And not just in a token way, but, you know, in a thorough way. Now, in the case of the acetic acid process, that was done so well, both by Foster and the process people at Texas City, that when that plant started up, it almost instantly produced design capacity, no problems.
Vladimir Hensel, who developed the platforming process for UOP, told me that once they had the process underway, they knew the right catalyst and so on. He was not involved until they started the plant up, and he was invited to the plant startup. I had asked him if he ever felt apprehension any way along the way, and he said not until we got to the day they started the plant up, and after 10 minutes they shut it down. He said, that's when I got scared, because I had been responsible for getting him to this point, and all of a sudden they're shutting everything down. It turned out it was a problem could be solved relatively easily, but he said that was probably his most worrisome moment, is when they reached the production stage and it didn't work right away. So you're saying that the lesson you learned at GAF allows you to avoid that.
Yeah, well, I think it instilled in me and could be used as a model for other people's thinking. If you're developing a new process, you really have to not only research the desired reaction, but think about and research the possibilities of undesired side reactions and what could happen if certain upsets occurred in the process. And the failure to do that has caused a number of for example, the attempted oxyrain development of their ethylene glycol process. If you ever sit down and talk with the gentleman who really invented that process and talk to him about what he did at the research stage and what they did at the process development stage, which he did participate in very much. See, it's another example of that sort of thing happening. But anyhow, I thought that I had gathered that particular lesson, if you please, from that experience.
You, after 3 years at JAF, you ended up back at Franklin Institute again.
Yes, I was at GAF, and as a result of the successful resolution of the butanediol process problem, they gave me an amazing award. They gave me a cash award of $1,000 or something, which was, I was told at the time, the largest award ever given for a research accomplishment in the history of that company. Mm. And about a month later, I got a phone call from the director of the laboratories at Franklin Institute telling me that my former boss, who was the manager of the chemistry division, had just left to go into business for himself. And they were offering me his position, at a 40% increase in pay, a private secretary, my own private parking space down at the Institute, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And gee, I thought about all of this, and it sounded, it sounds pretty attractive. And at the time, GAF was beset by the fact that there was a never-ending legal battle with between the government ownership of GAF and certain other organizations. There was an international organization called Interhandel, which was fighting the U.S. government over the ownership of GAF. And as a result of that, further progress in that company looked very, very, very grim. So I was receptive and took the job, and I got back, and then after 1 week, I thought, oh my God, what have I completely forgot about all the unpleasant things. This is really a contract research organization, and I realized that as manager, I would be spending very little time doing research per se, which is what I really wanted to do, but instead I would be become a salesman, try to get contracts. And while I was willing to contribute to the process, I was not willing to let that be my main occupation. So after a month, I decided, well, I'm going to give this thing 6 months. If I still feel the way I do now, I've made a terrible mistake and I've got to get out of this. And that's exactly what happened. And at that point, I decided that I was no longer going to stay in Allentown, Pennsylvania, where my family was very comfortable, but I was going to look for the best job I could find anywhere in the United States. And so I started a search, and that ended me up with Monsanto, which did not have a dedicated effort in catalysis research per se. And so I gave up my job as a manager of a 20-person department with all these perks and became a bench chemist at Monsanto.
Cut in pay?
Yes. As a matter of fact, there was a slight cut in pay.
That takes some courage to do that, then. The whole combination is really...
That's true, but I had I been a little wiser in the ways of the world, then I could have probably negotiated for at least a better deal, but at the time that was the offer, and I took it and went to Monsanto.
While you were at that 1 year, though, at Franklin Institute, I have a couple papers here that you published during that time. One back on solid propellants, and another one on oxidation reduction catalysis, the catalysts. Primarily, again, looking at combustion and pollution problems. Were that
no.
Chromite catalysts?
Yeah, but let me elaborate.
Or
on
is that I think
the title may be? Do you have the title there?
Oxidation reduction catalysis with Robert Doerr.
Yeah. Well, one of the other projects that I got involved in was once I had gotten involved in that project on trying to. Find the elucidate the nature of photochemical smog. I also became interested in the possibility of controlling emissions from automobiles, and in particular, I was interested in the possibilities of eliminating NOx emissions from automobiles by catalytic reduction with reductants such as carbon monoxide and hydrocarbons. And I had done some preliminary work, therefore, on that at the Franklin Institute.
because this shows up later on with Monsanto as well.
Yes, yes. Well, my initial, in fact, that may have been one of the things that attracted Monsanto to me. It was my background in this area, because my initial assignment at Monsanto was to work on water resource chemicals.
Oh, okay. That was the question I wanted to ask you. So you started there in 60 with the title I have of Research Specialist in Heterogeneous Catalysis.
Right.
Primarily assigned to work on auto emissions, and who did you report to?
Well,
what kind of group was it?
There was a sort of a chemical process group, and the man who hired me and who was my boss there was a man by the name of Jim Fair, who was a...
I've done an interview with Jim Fair. He's at University of Texas.
Okay, right.
Okay.
Well, Jim hired me and was my boss. And shortly after I was there, a year or two after that, he was moved from research into the chemical engineering unit of the company. They had set up a massive 1,000-person chemical engineering unit at Monsanto, and he became the director of fundamental chemical engineering research. He was quite an expert in distillation theory and practice. But this project was of interest to the company, and so I and a technician working for me in this department started this research. And in the process of doing that, I played a major role in developing capabilities at Monsanto in the characterization of heterogeneous catalysts. I was probably one of the first users of a number of techniques in their application to one of the first people to do in situ XRD studies of catalysts. I also did XAF studies of catalysts and developed these techniques. And as it later turned out, these techniques and capabilities became generally available and diffused in their use throughout the corporation.
I think there's a series of four papers on copper oxide on alumina in the late 60s,
right,
in which you used X-ray, ESR, ESCA, so on.
Right.
And so it was some, but you were doing this when you first started there, but it didn't show up in the literature until much later.
I probably did that during my first 3 or 4 years. Now, a lot of the work I did when Wolberg came along and several other people came along, Perrone and others, I did this on a collaborative basis later on. But I would say most of that work was done probably during the first 5 or 6 years at Monsanto, irrespective of when it actually got published.
Something I wanted to also ask in a general sense, and that is the company attitude towards publication of information of this kind, as opposed to some companies have a don't publish anything rule. What was Monsanto's attitude towards that?
Well, I found that Monsanto's attitude was sort of a mixed bag. Each business unit, each major profit center or division, passed on any application I might make for publication. And this was somewhat frustrating because, for example, the work that I did, which was my first major commercial success on the development of a process for making linear olefins for biodegradable detergents, that particular division was extremely hard-nosed and would not allow me to publish. But much of the work I did in that has never been published. On the other hand, the work I did in acetic acid I dealt with some people who were more liberal. So I would have to say that there was no singular company policy which dictated the whole situation everywhere. It varied. And in case we have time to discuss this, and when we get into the question of innovation, I would say that the attitudes and the culture regarding innovation vary in a major way between one unit and another.
Okay.
And I think some of those differences take place in other companies as well.
It was around the time that you started there that the industry knew they were going to switch from branch chain to linear groups in detergents for pollution study problems to get better biodegradable material. How soon did you get involved in that, producing the olefins that were required?
Well, what happened was that somewhere in the early, I came there in 60, and I must have worked on the auto exhaust until about 63, roughly, a year or two. Then they formed a corporate task force, and they appointed a man by the name of Leo Spillane out of the hydrocarbons division as the czar to develop a technology for producing linear olefins, because they were going to use them to alkylate benzene, and they knew that they would produce products of acceptable properties. And Leo had somehow or other become acquainted with my work in catalysis on the auto exhaust catalyst, and he was able to succeed in getting me reassigned to form a catalysis group effort in this project reporting to him. And so then that became my major project. And I had a group of about three professionals and three technicians. That's the first time I ever had a group of any kind there. And we worked on this. Initially, we started to work on molybdenum alumina catalysts because some of them had been studied in a preliminary way down at the hydrocarbons division, and they had some positive leads, and they wanted me to follow them up. And as it turns out, molybdenum alumina catalysts for reforming and dehydrogenation, well known in the literature. Well, I must have worked on them for about a year. Maybe I'm going to say a year to a year and a quarter. And early on, we learned enough to convince me that these catalysts were never going to make it. And I was then asked to, I asked them for permission to explore some other types of catalysts, specifically noble metal catalysts. They wouldn't allow me to do that. So, I did that, say, during even the first year. And finally, at the end of about a year or a year and a quarter, what happened was that the project moved along. There were certain technical goals in terms of conversion and selectivity which were set and which were necessary to achieve the requisite economics. And a decision was made to go to the board to build a plant. And the performance and economics which were presented to the board at that time were not actually anything that had in fact been achieved. They were just projected that they would be achieved. And I knew they weren't. They weren't achieved. It was at that point that I said, gee, you know, we have a bad situation here. We've got to break out of this box and start in some new direction. And they wouldn't let me do it. But then finally, when they got the approval from the board to go ahead with the plant, then I was unleashed. And I immediately started working with platinum-based catalysts. And within a fairly short period of time, in fact, when I tell this to people, they don't believe this. From the day I performed the first experiment with a platinum-based catalyst to the day there was the startup of a 150 million pound per year plant producing linear olefins was a total of 14 months.
Why platinum? What was it that gave you the lead to move to platinum, or the noble metals in general?
Well, it was a question of understanding the nature of acid-catalyzed hydrocarbon reactions. When we looked at the performance of the molybdenum catalyst, it looked like the side reactions, which were killing our selectivity, were skeletal isomerization caused by acidity, cracking to smaller fragments caused by acidity, formation, high formation of aromatics caused. We didn't want any of these things, so we decided, therefore, that what was needed was a low acidity catalyst. But then, when we started working with the platinum catalyst, we came quickly to the realization that, as in the case of reforming, to use a platinum catalyst, you've got to get you've got to get the maximum value out of every single platinum atom that you put in there. So we did a lot of work on achieving controlling the dispersion of the platinum throughout the pellet, finding out is it better to have all of it on the surface, as is in the case of reforming catalysts, or is it better to have it spread out, and what kind of and how do you control the acidity to control side reactions? And what do you do to the catalyst coke up? So you've got to develop a regeneration procedure. And in doing the regeneration procedure, you have to minimize the activation of the catalyst. So we went through all of this, and also to repress, as in the case of reforming, to repress coking, we had to have excess hydrogen present. So we had to study that phenomenon. And very quickly, within a few months, in fact, there was an engineer down at Texas City, Al McFarlane was his name. Al worked very closely with us on the molybdenum. But after 1 month of working with the platinum catalyst, I called Al up in Texas City and said, Al, all these reams of design documents that you have on the molybdenum catalyst, you're going to have to tear them all up. I said, we've now found out how to accomplish what is needed here. Well, it took a few months before they became convinced. Not much time, because then they went from there to scale it up. And in fact, a number of things were remarkable, because while the company had manufactured sulfuric acid catalysts itself for many years, it had never manufactured a noble metal catalyst, and the competition was so fierce and the need to move so rapid, very rapidly, so high, that a decision was made to manufacture the catalyst ourselves. So we then had to do work on developing a manufacturing process for making the alumina-supported platinum catalyst ourselves, which we did do. And for many years, until up to the time I left the company, I don't know. I think they sold that technology. I don't know how the catalyst for that plant is now currently made. So that was another facet of the exciting facet for us.
Involved at all in the development and scaling up phases, or was that turned over to another group?
Now, that was basically turned over to another group. And in the case of the dehydrogenation process, it was turned over to a group in Texas City, Texas, which is where they were going to build. They had a very large, they had a process development department there of a couple hundred people who were very experienced and very knowledgeable in process development and reactor design and reactor engineering. We had, in all fairness, I would have to say that while we had some interaction with them, it was modest. Mm-hmm. It was modest.
You've made some comments about this that I'd like to repeat and have you react to. One was, and I quote, "Those were the days when quality performance and personal empowerment were not practiced as slogans but as quiet realities."
Oh boy. Yeah, we're digressing from the technical development themselves, but well, I would use the example of empowerment, for example, in the acetic acid case, the fact that I and my colleagues were allowed to study the fundamental aspects of side reactions because we made the judgment that that was an essential part of developing the technology. I regard that as a form of self-empowerment. And another thing, how do we get into the acetic acid work to begin with? We were at a company conference reporting on some other work that we were doing on low pressure hydroformylation of olefins, and some research director from the name of Walt Knox said, "Gee, the price of methanol is coming down so low because of the introduction of centrifugal compressors and radial flow reactors, that if you could come up with a low-pressure process for carbonylating it to acetic acid, that would be terrific." Well, nobody said go to work on that. We just thought about it and thought about the possibility that might be. It was not an assigned project. We were not. Nobody did any arm twisting. It just was. It was intriguing as an outgrowth of our work in carbon monoxide carbonylation chemistry, and then we'll try it. And as you may have other recollections there, 11 days after our first experiment, the first one gave us zero yield, but when we added the iodide promoter, in 11 days we had discovered the rhodium carbonyl iodide catalyst. But I regard that as a form of self empowerment. Then, in terms of quality, I think that we had an opportunity to have more room in deciding on the nature and details of the research we were going to carry out than is the case today. I go to visit a petroleum company that's trying in the Philadelphia area that's trying to develop a major, has in fact commercialized a process, and it's giving something like a 60% yield of design production. And I start asking them about this, that. The research people know all of this. And I said, "Did you do that?" "No, we wanted to, but we were told by the business people that we didn't have time to do it. That we don't have time to do it. We can't do this. We can't do that." Well, those are basically technology decisions. And the people have been sort of disempowered of their ability to do the things that they should do in order to do a quality research job. But I think what's happened is that to a large extent, in the chemical industry today, the business sector of the company has assumed a much greater control over R&D operations to a degree that in fact compromises the ability to do quality R&D, and also compromises any that they talk about out of one side of the mouth about self-empowerment, but in reality they are themselves the biggest enemies of self-empowerment.
Mm-hmm. So it sort of fits in with the next statement, which is, those were the days before our current afflictions of paralysis by analysis and decision-making by committees that manage but do not lead. One more quote.
Okay. You really discovered all of them.
Well, because I have another question I want to ask you, but this will follow from this. Since Monsanto chose not to publicize its position and priority, neither the company nor its scientists had ever received much public recognition as the originators of this technology. Considering the large impact of the technology, this lack of recognition has continued to be a source of great disappointment.
Well, I'll tell you a story if you turn the tape recorder off.
Okay.
If you're willing to do that.
But what I did want to ask you, you said that GAF gave you $1,000 for, at a time when that was really quite something, for your contribution there. Did Monsanto recognize internally your contribution to these, to this process in any way?
Well, the only monetary contribution I got for the biodegradable, the linear olefins for biodegradable, was a $1,000 bonus. Hmm. Now, I did get promoted to the technical ladder, and I was appointed a scientist. So that gave me more status. They gave me a little pay, and so if you argued with them about that, why that was the case. Later on, when it came to the acetic acid, I think I got a $7,000 bonus. And when you consider that the intellectual, not their plan, but the intellectual property alone from that development brought them $100 to $200 million in royalties and license fees, I think they could have done better.
That was one of the reasons I wanted to ask.
But
all right. And I did want to ask you about this promotion to scientist, which was in 64. You said a technical ladder. Is this the first step on a
yes, there was side? I don't remember the titles, but the technical ladder at Monsanto was a three-tiered one, and the first one was a scientist, and then the next one was had some other title, and then the top one was the title of distinguished scientist. Monsanto was one of the earlier implementers of the technical ladder program, and they had a fairly large and relatively speaking, pretty good technical ladder program.
Had you ever thought about leaving the technical side and going into the other side, business side?
Yes, as a matter of fact, when I reached the point in my career after the acetic acid where I was a man by the name of Bill Williams came in as director of corporate research, and we sat down, and since I began to build up a fairly sizable, I had built up a 30-man catalysis department, and he said, I shouldn't be on the technical ladder anymore. He thought it was appropriate for me to make a choice between being a scientist or getting into management. So at that point, I thought about it and decided, okay, I think I can possibly make a contribution in R&D management. And at that point, I became director of first catalysis research and then process sciences, which encompassed electrochemistry and some other fields as well.
Okay.
So that was, but when I brought up the question, I thought that the track record that I had warranted my being considered for Director of Corporate Research, Central Research, Corporate Research. I was advised that if that was my aspiration, I really had to move into one of the profit centers to gain that experience and move into it, and I declined. I did not want to do that. I felt as though my first love was research, and having developed some commercially used processes while in corporate research, where I spent my entire career, should have been a demonstration enough that I was able to continue doing that. So, therefore, I never became director of Central Research at Monsanto, and while I was not actively looking for another job, in 1980, when I was approached, I was highly vulnerable.
I'll come back to that. The decision to move into homogeneous catalysis, and I'm not sure in the time frame that that occurred right after the linear olefin work.
Yes, that occurred because right after the linear olefin work, we had a new director of corporate research, a very flamboyant man by the name of Richard Gordon, who quickly assumed the name of Flash Gordon, not only at Monsanto, but throughout the industry. And he came roaring into my laboratory a few days after, a week or so after he had this appointment. He said, "Where's this Jim Roth I've been hearing about?" And he said hello to him. And he told me, "Well, I hear that you've been doing some good things, and what we need to do is have you do more of it. So I want you to start up a group, think about the scope and impact that the field of catalysis can have, think broadly about that, and come back and give us a proposal." So with that invitation, I decided to, it was at that point that I decided that there was one of the major things I could do was to expand into the field of homogeneous catalysis. And so that was not made to solve any single problem. It was a conscious decision to recognize that as one looked into the future, where might there be some opportunities? And that was it, and we went ahead and did it. Now, incidentally, again, question of self, there was a case of self-empowerment, because in doing that, I have seen other companies work. What they would do in other companies is they'd let you take some people from other parts of the company, retread them, even though they had no experience or track record in the field. I was allowed to go out and say to myself, who is the best consultant? I don't know this field. I know a little bit about who's the best person in the world I can get for this in the United States. And it was Professor Jack Halpern of the University of Chicago. I was allowed to go after him. I got him as our consultant. I began hiring two or three of his students. I had him come in one summer to give a week's summer course at the place, and that's where I personally learned about the role of iodide, which I then became my major contribution to the development of the acetic acid catalyst. And we then took off from there. So I think that that represented a high degree of self-empowerment and opportunity to build a high-class, world-class operation. It was not many years after that that the Japanese were organizing massive multi-million-dollar programs in C1 chemistry because of this vast effort which Roth and his co-workers have. We may have had 10 people working in the field. But
you built a new laboratory too, is that correct?
Yes, what we did was we had a high pressure laboratory building, and we acquired part of the space in that building and built Well, we established a group of people who are going to do nothing but operate high-pressure reactors for the chemists as part of the collaborative programs. And we achieved a very high degree of efficiency and collaborative effort between the engineering and chemical aspects of the homogeneous catalysis.
I mean, it sounds as if you were virtually given a blank check.
Well, you know, it may sound that way when you look at it today, but if you look at it at that time, and I look at other fields, I look at the field of polymers, and you know, I had a counterpart, a man by the name of Mel Hedrick, who was very successful in the field of polymer composites, and it was purely a technical man. Mel had a fairly similar charter. There weren't a lot of us, and then there was a man by the name of Bernie Wilde in the area of bioscience and bio. There were three or four of us who were given charters to do that sort of thing.
And was this Gordon's doing?
Well, I would
say. Or was it higher up?
No. Gordon answered to no one. In fact, that eventually led to his undoing. It's another interesting story that can only be repeated if the tape recorder off, as his office was locked one day and he was asked to leave within 2 hours. But nevertheless, he had a very enlightened attitude. Now, on the other hand, that's part of his success story. The new enterprise division, which he created, and which Monsanto must have poured $150 million in and led to practically nothing, was another side of the story. So he had created some successes and some failures. And interestingly enough, when the decision came to split these, he went with the new enterprise division, and left a little bit, mostly in central research, behind.
But yet, when you started in the homogeneous catalysis area, isn't it true that others were getting out?
Yes. DuPont had a very significant effort in homogeneous catalysis. Hercules had a significant effort, and there was at least one or two other companies. Engelhard had an effort in that area. Palladium-based oxymetallation chemistry. So there were three or four major companies that had been in the field for a number of years, and that was following the discovery and development of the Wacker process in Germany for making acetaldehyde, which is oxidized to acetic acid. But following that, then there was an intensive effort for 5 years, maybe, and then practically everybody was just bailing out. And that was the time that we elected to get in.
But nobody had used rhodium catalysts before.
Well, let me see. There was a limited amount of work that had been done with rhodium-catalyzed hydroformylation, primarily at Shell Development Company. And the man who had done that work was a man by the name of Lynn Slaw, who I just noticed. I know Lynn quite well. I haven't seen him for many years. He had just received next year's ACS Award in Industrial Chemistry. But it turns out... Good. He had done some work in fact, he was one of the earliest people who did work in phosphine-modified rhodium complexes for hydroformylation of olefins. He also used phosphine complexes of cobalt. And it turns out that his complexes were aliphatic phosphines. And it turns out that Shell actually commercialized commercialized aliphatic cobalt complexes for hydroformylation. The patent literature, at least, does not reveal any work by him in the area of the areophosphine complex. You know, I don't know your background.
I'm a physical chemist.
If you want or need any further description of any of what, it turns out that we were early on in that. So the question you put to me was, were we first in rhodium-based carbonylation? I think the answer to that is no, but we were among the first in rhodium areophosphine complexes for carbonylation chemistry.
And was this an outgrowth of your hiring Halpern student Pollock?
Yes.
Did he make
When Pollock came to work for us, he had done a postdoc at Halpern's laboratory, and he had been studying oxidative addition reactions to iridium and rhodium complexes, not catalytic ones. And he came, we asked him, okay, you're here, what would you like to do? He thought this was an interesting field, and so he started studying some reactions which involve displacement of carbon monoxide and displacement of hydrogen. And when they got mutual displacement of it, I said to Frank, it suggested that maybe these things may be hydroformylation chemistry. But he didn't even know what hydroformylation chemistry was, because he hadn't worked in that area, and it was an aspect of industrial chemistry that was not, I don't fault him for it. So he then began to work, and voila, these things were in fact, and we had a very intensive program that went on. And this went on first, but later on simultaneously with our acetic acid work. And we came up at the time our organic chemical division was interested in building a brand new plant for making the world's largest oxoalcohols plant. We were interested in getting them to pick up and follow up on our hydroformylation, rhodium phosphine catalyzed chemistry. Well, that particular division, as I came to learn later on, was headed up by a group of people who were zero risk takers. Once they started to do a little bit of work, and this was the work that Knowles did for them, which confirmed our results in rhodium-based hydroformylation, where you're reacting olefins with CO and hydrogen. And now it was up to them to decide what to do. So what they did instead was, they went out and licensed 20-year-old technology from a French company and built this world's largest plant based on proven, established, but old technology, as opposed to, in the meantime, closely behind us was Union Carbide. Union Carbide came along, and they elected to pursue this area themselves, which they did do, and have now licensed this extensively. So while the people in the hydrocarbons division was sufficiently entrepreneurial to be willing to pursue, develop, and take the risks of new process development, both in the linear olefins and in the acetic acid cases, these other people were not. And had they had, in my opinion, had they had more entrepreneurial people running that business, they would today have the position now held by Union Carbide, which is the preeminent developer and licensor of rhodium-based hydroformylation technology.
Well, one of the many pieces of a definition of innovation, risk is part of that. As you put together how different people look at innovation, risk becomes part of the equation in innovating. And That must have been quite a disappointment to you when they
When they did that, the only thing that kept our sanity was the euphoria that while we actually started acetic acid later, in the latter stages of our work on hydroformylation, it was the success of the acetic acid. It was not only that that kept us going technically, but one of the things that happened was that we had filed some patents and had earlier filing dates than Union Carbide on what was eventually to become their Pruitt-Smith patent, their primary patent in rhodium-based hydroformylation. And we, had we been more diligent, had we had more company interest, I know we had a basis for challenging the carbide patents, developing an interference, and in my opinion, winning that interference. However, there was no interest at all in that particular division in pursuing that and pursuing such an interference.
These different kinds of decisions that are made that we're talking about, kinds of decisions like this, are they made at the, what I'm going to say, for lack of any other term, the local level? How far up in the company does this kind of thing get bounced before? I guess what I'm saying is the top management aware of what's happening at this level?
I think the answer is sometimes yes and sometimes no. Let me give you an example of each. One of my colleagues at Monsanto was a man by the name of Manuel Beza, who developed an electrochemical process, electrohydrodimerization of acrylonitrile for producing a diponitrile, which became the world's largest organic electrochemical process developed by Monsanto about the time I did the work on detergents. They commercialized this. And how did that happen? Manuel Beza did all of his work in a little beaker, and he captured the interest and attention of a man by the name of Carol Hochwald, mm-hmm. who was at that time the corporate vice president of research. He reviewed all of this, and he made a decision. We are going to commercialize this technology. So he then went down to the textiles division located in the laboratories at Durham, happily found I think his name was Don Danley, a chemical engineer who was given the assignment to develop this, did a brilliant job because the field of electrochemical engineering was unknown to Monsanto. It was pursued, developed, a plant was built in Europe too. And how did it happen? It happened because in that case it got the interest and support of a senior management person who not only had the authority but also the disposition to say, we will commercialize this. In the case of, I learned something from that experience. And in the case of the work with acetic acid, I made sure that we were able, before we proceeded too far, to get the support of a senior management person in the hydrocarbons division. And it was with that support that we were successful. In those instances where, as in the organic chemicals or specialty organic chemicals division, the one that had responsibility for plasticizers at Monsanto, where we did not have that support, nothing happened. And we did not, at the same time, have a vice president of research
man was, at that time, was a man by the name of Monty Throdahl, who is well recognized, well regarded, and well respected, but Monty was not an entrepreneur. Monty would not attempt to challenge or override the decision of the people in the specialty chemicals division who elected to purchase rather than develop their own technology. So I think out of all of this, one, and this is nothing new, because if you go to, as I have, to the MIT Sloan School of Management, and you take Ed Roberts' course there, you learn one of the things that you need is you need a very proactive champion at the senior management level to make these things happen. And what's happening today is that the aversion to risk is even so much greater today, and the barriers to innovation are today so much greater that without that, you've got no chance. You've got no chance at all. And what happens sometimes is at Air Products, for example, we have developed some potential leads to new products, present them to the management of one of their profit centers. They will bucket down to somebody at a middle management level, and that person is so besieged by doing things that are politically correct, by taking minimal risks and so forth, that he'll assign a tenth of one person to do the commercial development market research related to that product. You know where that's going to go? Nowhere. So, am I responding?
Oh,
you know,
yes. Oh, yes. Excellent. So when you were turned down on the oxo-alcohol process, that they weren't going to use your technology, I'm not sure how long after that, when it was Walter Knox who talked about the possibility of making acetic acid from methanol.
It was just in the latter stages of that. We were at a company-wide conference. One of our people was giving a technical report on our work on rhodium-based hydroformylation, and how with these rhodium phosphine complexes you could hydroformylate at very low pressures, the catalyst was stable, you could use fractional distillation to take the product out and not decompose the rhodium catalyst, and had all these virtues that he said, gee, if you had those properties but for this other reaction, you'd have something worth considering. But that occurred when we gave an internal report at an internal company conference during the latter stages of that research work. Now, by the way, if I may interject this, going back to this, after Knowles finished confirming the work with the rhodium phosphine complexes for hydroformylation of olefins to aldehydes, he finished that work and he was casting about for a new project. It was then that he happened to read about the work of Professor Kurt Mislow at Princeton on the synthesis, an elegant generalized synthesis of optically active phosphines. And the thought came to his mind, well, gee, this guy Wilkinson has done hydrogenations at very mild conditions with rhodium phosphine complexes. This guy, what if I took one of his optically active phosphines, put them on the rhodium? So he shifted. It was a very comfortable shift because all he had to do was leave out the carbon monoxide, and he was in the hydrogenation system. Then he got into it. So I take a little credit for the fact that our effort, the effort that we took to commit the company to homogeneous catalysis, which got us into rhodium hydroformylation, had a ripple effect in getting Bill Knowles to do that work, and he entirely on his own was responsible subsequently for developing that area and for the world's first commercialization of optically active synthesis with a purely synthetic optically active catalyst.
Just going to move this paper back. We're picking up a little bit of the...
Sorry.
I was wondering, I thought I heard something, and that's what it was. It's just, because that's where they get. It was, well, the first experiments, when you were looking for acetic acid, and I think acetic acid was made from ethanol at that time, wasn't it?
No.
It was,
acetic acid, the process... At that time, in use throughout the world, was the Wacker process, in which ethylene was oxidized with palladium catalyst to acid aldehyde.
Okay.
Then the acid aldehyde would separately get oxidized to acetic acid. And that was, in itself, a major advance in homogeneous catalysis. Ours use entirely different raw materials. And of course, one of the intriguing things is that as part of the concern about energy independence, people were increasingly desirous of getting away from the use of intermediates and feedstocks derived from petroleum. Well, methanol and carbon monoxide can be made readily from coal or natural gas or petroleum. But it gives you a technology option of shifting your fundamental fossil fuel feedstock.
The first experiments were negative. And there are a number of examples in the history of science in which this becomes a very crucial decision when you get initial experiments that are negative, and do you pull the plug or do you continue? What was your reaction at this point? I know it was only 11 days till you added the iodide, but initially with negative results, what was your attitude towards continuing?
Well, I guess we asked ourselves the question of, well, why didn't it work? Because rhodium is so facile in reversibly interacting with carbon monoxide and undergoing insertion and reductive elimination reactions, why didn't it work? Well, we said the difficulty probably lied in forming a metal carbon bond between methanol, which is not an olefin, and all these olefins that we were using, any olefin in hydroformylation. So how can we do that? Well, then we remembered, I remembered the Halpern lecture where methyl iodide is a molecule that very prominently undergoes oxidative addition to D8 complexes, of which we were dealing with D8 complexes. Well, maybe what we need to do is add a little iodide so we can form some methyl iodide and overcome that. And you know, you can make 20 speculations of that kind, and maybe one out of 20 will work. But it was basically asking that. As far as I'm concerned, really asking that question, why didn't it work when carbonylation of all these other species, that the C2 and higher hydrocarbons did work? And it was the fact that methanol itself does not undergo oxidative addition, is not known to, so therefore there's not a pathway to form the metal carbon bond. Throw in some iodide, form methyl iodide, and...
It must have been very exciting, a result.
Yes, it was. It was sort of astonishing. I don't think, in a way, that the first experiment in which we produced substantial, can't tell you what it was, 20% acetic acid, made it still clear to us that what we had accomplished. We had to repeat it. We had to demonstrate our ability to do this almost quantitatively before the exhilaration set in.
5 months from the first experiment, and you were off to scaling up.
Well, we had developed a phenomenal body of data. By that time, we had evaluated all of the noble metals, we had evaluated a third of the periodic chart for alternatives, and we found some of them. For example, iridium worked almost as well. So that we had the basis for a very strong patent position covering catalyst compositions. And then we discovered some things related to, for example, the acidity. The medium must be acidic in order to convert the methanol to methyl iodide. If you added iodide, say, in the form of sodium iodide to an aqueous solution with no acid, you get no reaction at all, because that won't form methyl iodide. So we defined some of these conditions. In the meantime, I had one engineer who was studying the kinetics. And the kinetics were unbelievable. Here's a reaction between carbon monoxide and methanol that was zero order in both reactants. Mm. How can a reaction be that? Well, then in the meantime, Dennis Foster was on the side doing his studies of the elementary reactions in the sequence. He actually captured an intermediate and had a crystal structure done. And one of the, I'd say the research that Foster did and the kinetics work that Hirschman did, these would compare favorably in quality with the best of what you'd find in an academic laboratory. So we had turned some very excellent quality chemists and scientists to work on this.
The elucidation of the kinetics and the mechanism and side reactions again. This side reactions thing shows up almost every example we've talked about since your days back at GAF.
Yes.
But that, I understand, facilitated the scaling up process tremendously.
Oh, yes.
I'm not clear how long, 5 months it went to scale up at the petrochemicals division. How long was it before the plant started operating after that?
Did not any of the papers say what
no.
year it started the acetic acid process?
That's why I have that question here, because I didn't see the year.
I may have that.
Okay.
Plan start. I'm just going to guess. What was the year we started there? Did we start it in 69?
I'm not even. That's about right, I think.
I think the plant probably started up in 72 or 73, one of those two. But I think I may have a paper upstairs that would answer.
Okay.
That.
Well, when you get the transcript back, we'd probably just insert that year in there.
Yes.
Now, you started... There's a number of papers published about these rhodium catalysts between 68 and 75. I've counted seven different papers that you wrote that were in the literature about these catalysts. And again, I come back to the question of, was this the group that encouraged publication of papers? You said it varied from one group to another.
We were largely dealing with the people in the hydrocarbons division. I would say that by and large, they had what I, from a self-serving interest, describe as an enlightened attitude toward publication. They didn't ask us to publish, but they responded carefully. And by and large, what we did was. Very often we would publish things that were already disclosed in our issued patents. And we took the position that our competition is not stupid. If it's there in the patent, they know about it. They've read about it. Probably, if they're interested, they've even checked them out.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We've already talked about Bill Knowles and his work as an offshoot of the acetic acid process. I don't know if there's anything else you want to add there or not.
Well, Well, you know, if you're interested in innovation, I think there's an interesting feature of that at least I find interesting, and that is that commercialization also occurred around 73. And in the meantime, there was a lot of research, including academic research, all over the world that kind of followed in the footsteps of the Knowles work. And it became a very popular field for academic research, and nobody ever came up with anything else commercial. In the meantime, about in the late, when would that have been? About the late 80s, maybe almost 15 years later, the Japanese came up with a major advance in the field through the development of some. There's a professor, Nayori, who has developed something called the BiNAP, rhodium and ruthenium catalysts. And they got commercialized in Japan, and that has now opened up a whole area of research. Now, almost every pharmaceutical company in the world has an effort going on in asymmetric catalysis, and have products that have been introduced or are about to be introduced. And in fact, in the sense of trying to make more environmentally friendly bioactive molecules, if that molecule is optically active, it's predicted that in the future it will be the desired optically active antipode that will be made and manufactured. So this is a big activity. When I look at what Knowles did and said, why did it take over 20 years, about 20 years, for this to go from some initial stage of introduction to the point at which there is at least commercial proliferation of the technology? I'm puzzled. I would have thought that once the stone got turned over, it would have happened faster.
What is the... And what was it at the time you started the availability of rhodium for making these catalysts? Was it readily available?
Oh, yeah. You can just buy ordinary rhodium salts from Engelhard, add the phosphine ligands, which you can make yourself or buy somewhere, have somebody make for you, and throw them into a reactor. There's not a difficult... It's not the availability of these. I think it's more the... two things, making the commitment to work in the area, and two, putting some really creative people to work on them.
Another thing that grew out of the acetic acid work was the ability to make acetic anhydride, although Monsanto never pursued that. And 21 years to get the final patent, was that something like that?
Yeah. Well, what has happened in the meantime is that a number of people filed from Eastman Chemical, Halcon, Chevron, and other places filed and obtained patents related to anhydrides. And Monsanto filed a patent related to that, which was a CIP of its original acetic acid carbonylation case. But it ran through an almost endless stream of objections and difficulties. And I have the letter from the attorney that after 21 years of uninterrupted prosecution, we have now obtained this. And so that particular issued patent, if you trace it back to its initial filing date, is the earliest patent in acetic anhydride. Mm. But again, since the company had decided not to pursue it commercially, the amount of attention and resources which were devoted to the prosecution of that patent was modest, to say the least.
Mm-hmm.
But since the catalyst, which is the basis of Eastman Chemical's $500 million complex going from coal to acetic anhydride, is a rhodium iodide based carbonylation catalyst, I think it's fairly clear that that it is a derivative of our work in rhodium based carbonylation. So as I said in this paper, a couple of things Monsanto did not commercialize. They didn't commercialize rhodium based hydroformylation. They didn't commercialize rhodium based carbonylation under anhydrous condition to produce acetic anhydride. Business factors were behind the decision not to pursue those commercially.
By 1973, you were moving away from being involved in this research yourself to some extent and becoming more of a manager, as you indicated earlier. Once you had made that conscious decision to do that, how did you feel about it after you were managing others now?
Well, there were times at first, particularly when I had some doubt in my mind as to whether I'd made the right decision or not. But as I reflected over my own scientific career, I thought that, I've really been very lucky, very fortunate, because how many people who get into the business of chemical research ever have the good fortune to be the inventor or senior inventor of a major new chemical process? And I had the good fortune to have that happen to me twice. Not once, but twice. And how many people who have ever invented a heterogeneous catalytic process have ever then had a homogeneous process commercialized? Because the fields are so vastly different. I don't know of anybody. So I've been pretty lucky. So that maybe I could try my hand at something else, and that's in the area of research management. And when I went to Air Products, I was hired there to start up from ground zero a new long-range exploratory research unit. And I was given a fairly a liberal charter to do that. But one of the things that I was determined to do was to build what I would call a world-class organization. This is in a company that had had really no strong heritage at all in chemical research. They're basically a chemical engineering. They had a few chemists there. But now, I think I succeeded. I think they now have a world-class organization with respect to a number of fields. When I came there, they had done no work at all in the field of zeolite materials. I think they have now, their capabilities in zeolite materials research is in the top rank of throughout the world. And they are beginning to exploit this in terms of commercial applications. They had never attempted to synthesize an organic polymer as a membrane. Well, they're in the forefront of that field. Another field, the area of molecular complexes. My colleague Guido Paz has just successfully developed the world's first family of stable, reversibly binding metal complexes that will bind oxygen. So I enjoy a certain amount of satisfaction, but on the other hand, I'm very frustrated by the fact that the commercial benefit to the company of this technical capability has been very modest. It's not a subject related to I think I responded to your question about.
Well, when you set out, as you did at Air Products, to build a world-class laboratory, it takes more than just money. I mean, you have to have the financial resources, obviously, but what else is there? What do you do when you set out to do this? That's a pretty challenging directive to take a company that's got a strong but rather stodgy track record and all of a sudden say, we're going to be involved in chemical innovation and we're going to do great new things. How do you do that? What do you look for besides the fact that the financial resources are there?
Well, part of it was done a little bit for me by the man who hired me, Bob Lovett, because he had decided that we really needed some centers of expertise. There were certain technology underpinnings of most of our strategic businesses. For example, organic synthesis was a major underpinning of the and polymer synthesis of the chemicals units of the company, which comprise about 40% of the company. Advanced gas separation technology was another. Catalysis was another. So he had defined, when I took the job, he had defined five areas. Of those five areas, I embraced about four of them. The fifth one, which was cryogenic technology, is largely mechanical engineering oriented, and I did not feel qualified to head up and lead such an effort. So I sort of defaulted on that one. And again, I thought, okay, we're going to operate in this. We have to have somebody heading up each of these areas who had an established track record of achievement and creativity in each of these fields. And I was empowered to go out and hire each of them at what we called our chief scientist level. A level so high that there was no one in such a position in the company. Well, I went out and tried to do that. I could identify the people, but every one of these people was so well recognized within their own organizations that I had no chance whatsoever of recruiting them. There's no way I could offer them the incentives. They had the golden handcuffs because of their years in the retirement plan and so forth. So I couldn't do that. Well, the next best thing was to try to find people who were at an intermediate level who, in my judgment, had the potential for developing, and that's what I did do. And so then I went out to hire. I went out to hire some people. I hired Paz from Allied. I hired Armour from Allied. I hired Orville from Monsanto. And I hired Robeson from Union Carbide. But these are all people who are moving rapidly into national and international recognition on their own right. And then I worked with them to try to instill in them the importance of, when they were building their staffs, of looking for and not compromising themselves on anything less than first-class people who had demonstrated creative. They may know nothing about industrial research, but they should have somewhere demonstrated creative abilities in chemical research in their respective fields. So what happened? In fact, the first exercise in recruiting that I had there of young people was got me in a little bit of trouble, because I worked with the personnel department. We identified Roberts, who was going to be coming here from Penn State or some other place. And okay, we settled a date, and they went ahead and they set up an interview panel. And what did they have on the interview panel? They had all managers and directors of research. I went through one of these and then read the evaluations, and these were ridiculous. This was entirely a personality evaluation. There was no critical evaluation of these people's technical ability. So I went back to them and said, I'm sorry, we can't continue like this. From now on, I will make up the panels of the people who will. And I got chose among technical. I might have had, if we had 8 or 9, I might have had one R&D management person besides myself on the panel, and tried for the first 50 people that we hired. I was personally involved in recruiting every one of them. So technical ability and creativity became the standard that we were looking for once we got the senior people in place.
Mm-hmm. What do you do in the case where, well, most of what we've talked about, your experiences have been with teamwork. What do you do when you have somebody who may be extremely creative but prefers to work alone, or is of that bent at least?
Well, that was a very difficult one, because at first I came to believe that my organization should have sufficient flexibility that we should be able to accommodate people who were loners or eccentric in such a way that they really could work by themselves. But after having gone through a number of experiences, I sort of rejected that. And have come to the conclusion, I found this particularly even with the senior people who run the departments, that it's absolutely essential among them that they be able to, that they satisfy the technical qualifications I'm looking for, but that they have interactive abilities which will enable them to work effectively with other people who are needed in order to fill out the full complement of skills and capabilities needed to get the job done. And so I would say, particularly in the last 5 years of my 10-year stay at Air Products, that was one of the essential qualifications. And there were a number of people who were rejected as potential candidates because of the judgment made that they would not be able to work well with other people. I'm sure that people who would debate that give episodic incidents that run counter to that, but that was my experience.
I have a couple things for you that were left over from Monsanto. We had moved into Air Products, but let me back up if I could to Monsanto again. When was it that the company decided to get out of catalysts on for auto emissions? I'm not clear, but it was the decision to get out of that business was made rather abruptly, if I'm correct.
Yes, it was made very abruptly. It turns out that our program was going along, we were doing very well. We were working with General Motors in collaboration with them, and we're doing very well. We were either number one or number two among a half a dozen people that they were working with in terms of performance. She'll show up. uh, Then something happened at Monsanto. It turns out they went through a period of financial stress. The man who was president of the company resigned rather suddenly, and the chairman took over, a man by the name of Charlie Summers. And within a day or two after he came in, he had the view that you cannot work with the automotive companies and make any money. So he made a singular, unilateral decision that program would be terminated. Mm. It had nothing to do with our performance, but with a decision that that program could only benefit through a business venture with the automotive companies, and he decided that we could not do that profitably. Therefore, stop it.
That kind of decision at that level didn't happen too often, though, did it? Or did it?
I would say at that level, no. But decisions of that kind at somewhat lower levels, you know, maybe a division vice president or something else like that has on occasion made decisions like that, but not the president or chairman of the company. Sharon? Hi.
Hello.
Come in and say hello.
Hello.
Okay.
I'll go continue until 11.
Yeah.
In that line, I wanted to ask you, how much of an imprint does a new CEO leave on the company at the lower, and let's say, the research levels?
Well, in some cases, leave a major imprint. And sometimes in surprising ways. Let me give you an example. One of the things that happened at Air Products when I came there was that in order to get involved in a major way with any major research project, we had to get the blessing of the profit center most closely related to that. And so our entire program more or less required that we gather an assortment of blessings. And that, in some cases, meant that we could not work on some things which in our judgment should be worked on. Well, this went on for many years, and all of a sudden we had a change, and Dexter Baker came in. When he came in, the vice president of research was able eventually to negotiate with him and change that premise. We were no longer required. We were encouraged to do it and try to do as much of it as we could. But if we had a program that we had very strong conviction about and which the vice president of research would support, we could proceed. So that might be viewed as our ability to select our programs was influenced by who was running the company and how they were going to control the funding of our programs. So,
we mentioned earlier your involvement with Roundup, but just sort of in passing, can you say anything more about you were managing?
Yes.
You were. I think at that point you were already director of process sciences for Roundup.
Right. What had happened there was that. It was a little bit ironic because I ended up, when I became director of process sciences, I acquired responsibility for the electrochemistry group under Baser. But just before that had happened, the people in the agricultural chemicals unit of the company had discovered the compound Roundup, had field tested it and found it had extremely interesting properties, and the few pounds that they needed had been made by brute force methods that would not at all be suitable for a commercial process. So it was going ahead, but now they had to develop a commercial process. And they were working with the electrochemical engineers who had developed, there's a key oxidative cleavage step involved in making it, and they had developed an electrochemical process for doing this, and they were about ready to start building the pilot plant when a number of us got together, looked at the chemistry, and said, gee, we think you might be able to do that catalytically. And so we went ahead and began, without much approval or anything, to just start some research in the area. And then we reported to the people in the Ag Chemical that we were working on it, and they were kind of skeptical, but they didn't say, stop, don't stop it. And then, all of a sudden, we had a team, a chemist and an engineer, who were working on this. One of the engineering, the engineer on the program, did an extremely insightful analysis of a body of data that he had collected, and he had been looking at platinum on carbon catalysts, and come to the conclusion that the platinum was contributing very little. It was just the support itself. This was through data analysis. And voila, went ahead and tried it, and the carbon itself was in fact the catalyst, which was commercialized, and a determination was made that he, this engineer, was the sole inventor on that particular process. And the economics and everything else about it looked so much more attractive than the electrochemical process that it was dropped, and the catalytic process developed in our department was the one selected for rapid commercialization. So the bottom line is we developed the process for producing glyphosate, which is the active ingredient in Roundup. And it was us, essentially, who made the determination that we thought we had a good chance of being able to perform the reaction. Now, it's interesting because that reaction is not conducted commercially for any other reaction. Mm. It involves oxidative cleavage of a carbon, selective oxidative cleavage of a carbon-nitrogen bond. An aliphatic carbon-nitrogen bond. But I felt good about that, obviously good, because we had contributed to that wonderful, very profitable product, but also it was a further, justification of this concept of involving engineers not in the development and scale-up, but at the very exploratory stage. And it was the engineer, in this case, who was responsible for it all.
When you reach the latter stages of management of research at Monsanto, how did you feel, let me back it up a moment, up to that point you had to sell people on your ideas. Now you're having people sell you on their ideas. You're on the other side of the fence, as it were. Is that true? I mean, how did you react to that?
No, I don't think that was really true, because there was the interaction of Monsanto was what I call a push-pull interaction. Sometimes we were asked to assist in something. Sometimes it was in a very subtle way, like, gee, if you could do this. Mm-hmm. Now, nobody said do it, nobody asked us to do it, but it planted a seed. But we took the initiative to do it. Now, in another case that I haven't mentioned, my group also developed another process that was commercialized. Maybe, I don't know if it appears in the paper, but one of the divisions, it was in fact that specialty chemicals division again at Monsanto, was interested in getting into the business of making diphenyl ether and doing so by the coupling of phenol. And so they asked us to work on it. We worked on a collaborative program and we developed the catalytic technology that was used and commercialized for making it, for producing it at a significant commercial level. In the case of the linear olefins, there's a case where we were specifically asked. I would say probably the work on acetic acid, if viewed impartially, would be viewed as one where we provided the initiative. The L-DOPA was one where the people, the researchers, provided the initiative. The diphenyl ether the other way. So it was kind of a mixed bag.
Let me return again to some general comments that I pulled out of some of the things you wrote. If you wish to do some trailblazing and create technology leadership positions, don't follow the bandwagons.
Well, this gets into an aspect of innovation development that I've spoken about when I talk about the nature of the S curve. Have you read any of the paper that discusses the S curves?
No.
Okay. Well, what happens, I have written, is that for any given technology, it kind of goes through an S curve. And I'm not the originator. This is the nature of the learning process. And when a technology is mature, then you have to spend a lot of time and money to make a very small further advance. And what happens at that point is a discontinuity occurs and someone comes along. You end up, you start out by making acrylonitrile from acetylene, and you do that as well as you can, continuously making small improvements. Voila, somebody comes along and it's Ohio and makes it from propylene, and that, you know, this is a technology discontinuity. The maturity of chemical technology today is such that most of them are on the upper portion of this S curve, and what will be needed is a technology discontinuity. If you want to make a discontinuity, you're not going to do so by trying to incrementally evolve yourself there by continuing to follow and doing what other people are doing. When Pez started out with a few of the known complexes, but he quickly gave them up, and the ones he now has when the answer is a new composition of matter, that's a discontinuity usually, and that's not something that you're going to make that did not evolve from following the bandwagon, if you please, or from trying to incrementally expand that which we already know. And it takes very creative people to be able. Guido Paz is probably the most creative chemist I have seen in American industry. When I've gone to Guido, who worked for me at Air Products for 10 years, and I tried to get him to work on a problem that represented an incremental, could never get him to work on it. He wouldn't want to work on it. He wasn't sufficiently challenged.
Is the ability to see these discontinuities a function of age? Do you see, does age have anything to do with it?
Well, I wonder. Now, Bill Knowles, when he did his pioneering work on asymmetric catalysis, was well into his 50s. Pez, who was just, I think, really come up with this new, which this, his new complexes are now about, he's been working on this for 10 years. He's just turned 50. You know, I don't know whether you regard that as young or old or whatnot. On the other hand, some of the other things that I've seen have been done by younger people who kind of are maybe less encumbered by conformity and are willing, more willing to engage in free thinking.
Yes, one of the reasons I asked that was because it seems that if you spend a long period of time in a single area, that there's a danger of not being able to see beyond.
Well, what Pez did in his case was, it turns out that he himself did not make the breakthrough. I think you have a good point here. He worked with a series of young people. They would come to work for him for 2 or 3 years and they'd move on to something else. The person mostly responsible for this now major breakthrough is a new person who came to work for him. Ram Prasad. Yeah? And he is a young scientist. And he is the one who came up, he more than Pez came up with a new approach, these cyano-cobaltic type complexes, for some reasons that were doubtful even to Pez. I just accredited Pez because he's continuing the program, but if you pin me down and said, well, who really came up with that, it was really Ram Prasad, and he's a younger person. He's a younger person. But Pez has had a phenomenal record of finding the problems, mm-hmm. hiring these people, motivating them, and getting remarkable results out of them.
A few other quotes.
My God.
The career of an industrial chemist is often erratic. It shuttles between occasional moments of success and euphoria that are all too infrequent, and many interludes of frustration, disappointment, and even disenchantment. And you wrote that with a feeling that says you experienced every single one of those categories that you mentioned.
Well, many people who work in exploratory research and industry never achieve a major commercial success. That has got to be frustrating. I know my wife, who's not a scientist, says she could never do long-range research because the personal, emotional need that she has for seeing the results of her endeavor in some reasonably short time is too strong. She wants to get closure on and completion with regard to her efforts. Frustration occurs when you come up with something new, but because of the weak commercial development or business reason or something else, the company makes a decision not to follow up on that, that can be enormously disappointed. I know of a man by the name of Albert Chan, who I think for that reason left Monsanto because he had come up with a new synthetic route to one of these high-valued analgesics that are being sold, and the company decided not to pursue it. So different factors. It takes a long time. It's very difficult to achieve success. And sometimes when you've achieved success, and I think today, as I look about the world of chemical technology today, the weak response of corporations in general in terms of supporting the commercialization of new opportunities, investing in them, and exhibiting the patience and financial investment that's required is very discouraging to people I've seen.
And is there much of a reward system? We're saying here, as you said correctly, many people go through their whole career and don't have a major breakthrough in commercialization. Most people seem to like some kind of reward system along the way. I mean, to have some kind of recognition, even if it's internally within the company. And how much does the chemical industry today, as opposed to your time, have a reward system for its research people?
Well, it's getting better. It has created technical ladders. Many companies have technical ladders which assign special recognition and some increased financial recognition and reward to those people who are the top performers. In terms of other things like special awards, I know Monsanto has established the so-called Queenie and Hochwald awards, and Air Products now has an award that's either $25,000 or $50,000 that can be given at the chairman's discretion, so people can get those rewards. So I think that's a step in the right direction, because having operated myself now for a number of years, particularly my career at Air Products in the executive branch of the company, I'm fully aware of the compensation opportunities that exist for business executives or management executives in the company, even the technology management executives, in terms of bonuses and stock options and so forth, things that help me buy and furnish this place, yeah, that are not open to people in the R&D ranks, or very few of them. I think to a large extent, and I can't philosophize about societal changes, but scientists have historically and even today continue to get as one of their rewards the self-satisfaction that they feel in recognizing their own accomplishments in a scientific or technological context, whether or not they're roaring commercial successes. Mm-hmm. And that's manifests itself in a different way. For example, presenting papers at national and international meetings, that's a perk that many scientists enjoy. Receiving awards, those that are good enough to achieve those forms of recognition, memberships in honorary societies like the National Academy of Sciences, National Academy of Engineering, all of these are forms of reward and recognition that are given outside the confines of the company. So there are some. But I think as society becomes increasingly focused on financial rewards,
that's going to become more and more an issue for scientists.
Another quote. In today's environment, translating new knowledge into a profitable commercial product is not easy. The barriers that one encounters are at times overwhelming. There are many commercial, financial, and cultural hurdles to overcome. I was struck particularly by the inclusion of a cultural hurdle. I can see commercial and financial, but cultural was...
Well, perhaps...
Surprising.
Perhaps the... I would include under the nomenclature cultural such things as aversion to risk, lack of self-empowerment, and other things of that sort. Okay. But one of the things that I've said to one of my colleagues at Air Products, who is always looking for ways to achieve more technology breakthroughs, is that I'm now convinced, as I sit back in the wisdom of my years of retirement, that if somebody came along and presented an opportunity for a Roundup or an acetic acid to Air Products, they would fail to commercialize it and convert it into the commercial success that each one of them achieved. Now that's a pretty powerful statement.
Yes.
And I believe that to be the case.
That's a mindset, you're saying, as a mindset there that would not...
Yeah, I would elaborate on that point if you turn the tape recorder off.
Okay. I should have had this on because I'd like to had that part of it on the record. But we'll come back to that because I'm almost through with quoting your statements for you to comment on. One last one is, conventional wisdom is rarely the pathway to technical leadership.
Well, that's kind of a restatement of this business of following the bandwagons and not going to be the path to come up with major novel innovations.
You have this list of agenda questions that we've pretty well covered at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Let's take a look at number 15, the last two. What is important for the future of R&D? And you've just said to me before as we were off the record that you felt most innovations would be coming from outside the United States. So could you elaborate on what you think is important for the future of R&D in this country?
Well, I think that what's happening is that most of the research, by far the great majority of research in this country, is aimed at incremental improvements in products or in processes, and that the opportunities that exist will likely come from the outside because they're not being worked on here. And what I have tried to do in the field of catalysis, which I know quite well, is to identify major unsolved problems that I think, if solved, would provide innovations and breakthroughs. And one of the papers I have given one. Let me just give you the highest volume product produced in the United States is sulfuric acid.
Mm-hmm.
The technology for producing that is quite old and hasn't changed maybe in 50 or more years. And yet, if you look at that and you ask yourself the question, what are the limits of this technology? What are its characteristics? It turns out it's a fairly capital-intensive process. And one reason is that
present catalysts require that the oxidation of SO2 to SO3 occur at fairly high temperatures, like 500 plus degrees centigrade, at which point the thermodynamics only allow you to go to substantial but incomplete conversion. What you then have to do is to go through multi-stage reactors, and boy, that represents a lot of money, and there are people who would like to get those SO2 emissions, the unconverted ones, down further so that the emitted SO2s don't photooxidize in the atmosphere to contribute to acid rain. When you look at all of that and you say, well, what could we do about that? Well, one of the things we could do about that is to develop a low-temperature catalyst. If we had a catalyst that, for example, would oxidize SO2 to SO3 at 200 degrees centigrade rather than 500 degrees centigrade, it would have an enormous difference, reducing the size of the reactors that are needed. Maybe you could, I have not figured this out, you might do it in one reactor. Reduce the capital, reduce the energy intensity, improve the environmental situation. Gee, that sounds so, question is, so obvious. Who's been working on that problem in the last 30 years? I know of no one. Now maybe I don't know, but someone will come along. Maybe someone will read one of my papers somewhere in Poland or in the Soviet Union or in Korea and so forth, and they'll work on that problem and they will come up with a low temperature catalyst. And when they come up with that low temperature catalyst, they will have a technology that will dominate the future process technology for making sulfuric acid. And I can go down the list of the 50 top chemicals that are produced in the United States and produce a scenario based on describing the limits of existing technology and looking at the reasons for those limits and project a potential scenario for a new... I can't tell you how to do it, mm-hmm. but they exist there. And what I can say for the field of catalysis, which is very important and very big, could also be said for polymers or could be said for other established fields. And it's not being done. So you ask, what could be done? What could be done is to pursue, I think, what I'm suggesting, which is to look at this so-called mature chemical industry and ask ourselves incisively, what possibilities are there for drastically changing the processes and in some cases the products that we presently make and displacing them and doing research along, I'm not saying all the research, mm-hmm. but that would create an enormous body of research which is not now being pursued at all in deference to small incremental improvements of what we are already doing.
The last question on my list says, what effect did winning the Perko, what did it, well, let me rephrase it from what it says there. What did it mean to you to win the Perkin Medal?
I guess I thought a little bit about that. I guess I have a small answer to that question. That is, I think it gave me a sense of increased self-worth. Because before winning the Perkin Medal and being the fortunate recipient of that medal in an event in which there were 400 to 500 people, executives from all over the country, coming to help celebrate the scientific and technical accomplishments of my life, I didn't feel as though, one, my accomplishments were perhaps as important as I now feel they are, although as widely recognized. So in terms of the value of what I've accomplished in my life, I think has been made to look better, to me at least, as a result of having won the Perkin Medal.
Okay. Is there anything you'd like to add that I haven't covered?
No, there's another aspect of this business of what's important for the future of chemical R&D. One of the other issues, besides developing a group with technical creativity which can address what I'm going to call the unsolved problems of industrial chemistry, is to have commercial and business development people who, in a complementary way, can work creatively in that arena. For example, we came up with a new set of ortho-alkylated aromatic amines, and it was necessary to try to find uses for these. Well, I was very dissatisfied with the commercial and business development effort which was applied to finding out what they would be good for, because even from my limited knowledge, they might be good as antioxidants, they might be good as agricultural chemicals, they might be good as components of certain types of polymers and so forth and so on. So that in order to improve the prospects for the future of chemical R&D, we need to pursue these unsolved problems of chemistry, but not only creatively in the R&D sector, but also creatively in the commercial and business development sector. And I feel that the latter is very often been the reason for a lack of success. Somebody's come up with a technical lead which has gone nowhere. But I do firmly believe that these things are not insoluble, and that some of what I'm suggesting here may have some merit in trying to create a conceptual design for addressing the future, because the mistake that many people make is that they look at the way it was done before, 40 years ago, 30 years ago. The academics have always enjoyed totally free ability to do untethered research, just generate new knowledge. That was wonderful 40 years ago. Today, as the science and technology has matured, I personally think they should be working more, not entirely, but more in focused fundamental research than they are. And I think the approaches we need in terms of organizational design and approaches to face the future have to be different from what we've been using.
Well, excuse me, on that note, I think I'll thank you very much for spending the afternoon with me. I certainly enjoyed it, and you've certainly given us some very good information. So thank you again.